Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Georgia Summers about her fantasy novel, The City of Stardust. Georgia is half British, half Trinidadian, and spent most of her life living across the world, including in Russia, Colombia, and the US. She now lives in London. Georgia has previously worked as a bookseller, a student librarian, and an editor at Tor UK, Pan Macmillan's fantasy imprint. In this episode, we discuss how she was inspired by stories from her childhood describing portals to another world, using real places to inspire her fantastical world building, and her insight as a former editor, and whether she writes with commercial decisions in mind. But first, here's Georgia with an excerpt from The City of Stardust.
A whisper is chasing across the world. A woman in Italy hears it, and that night she locks up her house. She bundles her children into the car, along with as many belongings as she can pack. When they ask where they're going, she only accelerates down the twisting countryside roads, grim determination reflecting back at her frightened children in the rearview mirror. The whisper reaches a jeweller in Seattle, who promptly faints after scanning the letter. He keeps trading. What else can he do? But buys a gun, storing it carefully underneath the till point. 6 months later, he's discovered dead in his back office, slumped over his desk with the gun still in his hand. The police assume suicide and close the case, even though his wife insists they were being watched by a woman who could vanish into thin air. In Osaka, Gabriel Everly overhears the whisper as he sits alone in a cafe, dusk falling across the horizon. He closes his eyes, holding onto it for a painful moment before releasing it back into the world. The next evening, he's in a different city, in a different country, and only then does he feel the tension in his shoulders give way. The whisper gathers pace like a boulder careening downhill. It passes through telephones and hidden letters burned after reading, encrypted emails and clandestine meetings by candlelight. And somewhere in between, it crosses to a different world, carried on a breeze to a city of snow and starlight, where it has already been circulating for quite some time. Where is Marianne Everly?
Hi, Georgia. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, The City of Stardust.
Hello. I'm excited to be here.
Thanks so much. Can you start then by telling us what The City of Stardust is all about?
Yes. So The City of Stardust is about the Everly family who are cursed. So every generation, they lose one of their best and brightest to this sort of mysterious woman called Penelope, who never ages, she never gets sick, and she never forgives a debt. So 10 years ago, Violet's mother goes off to try and break the curse and vanishes. And now Violet must go off and find her mother or end up becoming the curse's next victim. And sort of to do so, she sort of ends up in a sort of secretive, magical underground filled with these like shadowy scholars, powerful gods, vengeful monsters, and kind of all the sort of horrific and wondrous things in between.
It's such an imaginative premise, and I just can't imagine where it all began. So can you give us a flavor of where that initial spark came from?
So the sort of slightly strange truth is that this is like a real hodgepodge of ideas. Like I think, most of the time when I write, I sort of tend to think about a book coming from one particular scene I have in my head or one particular like setup. But for this one, it really was like, I just have a bunch of different things I love and I would stick them all in there and see what happens. So I mean, I think I've always loved portal stories. I think, I read a lot of those growing up, like, Narnia and His Dark Materials. And, I was also the child that was like, if I just sit in the wardrobe at the right time with the right book and I get the door closed all the way, the back of the portal, the back of the wardrobe will open and I'll be sucked into whatever magical adventure I was reading at the time. And it never happened. But I tried quite hard for probably more years than I should have before I was like, oh, maybe that's not going to happen. I also wrote a short story at university about a man who made sort of these gifts out of this magical metal. I mean, it was everything. It was like there was Spirited Away fan art that I really loved, which sort of shows Chihiro, who's the main character of the film, going back to this sort of tunnel where she has had this sort of amazing, sort of like life-changing moment of magic with this sort of boy Haku. And so she goes back as a slightly older and sort of, the world doesn't open up to her again. And she sort of says, okay, I'll come back tomorrow. And it really struck me as like, well, what if you like, what does that singular moment look like? What does it feel like to come away from that and just sort of go back to your normal life, but know that there is this possibility of so much more out there. I also wrote this book during the pandemic, and it's quite a wide-ranging book. Like, my main character Violet, she goes all over the world, and I was like, well, I am going nowhere. So I sort of wanted to write a book where she could go all the places that I couldn't at the time.
And I get the sense just from you speaking that kind of fantasy is your number one love. And if you were going to write a book, it would always be a fantasy book. Is that right? Or have you kind of played with other genres, or had you tried to write a novel before this?
Yeah, so yeah, I would say fantasy is definitely my like one big love. I read a lot. I would say very widely. I enjoy a really wide range of genres, like everything from like nonfiction to fiction, and that encompasses a big range. But I will say, in terms of writing, I just for some reason it's fantasy that really sticks with me. And I've always written. We wrote sort of roughly almost a book a year from about 13 onwards, thanks to the powers of NaNoWriMo, for better or for worse.
Have you
And
completed it
then,
every year?
oh God, no, I think I got to about 19 or 20, and I was like, you know what? I'm actually a much when I write slower, I write better and I pay more attention to what I'm doing. And also, I started to get things like a job and going outside more often. And that does, to write a whole novel in a month is, as I know now, it's extremely challenging, and to do it well. But it was incredibly valuable just to have, just to be able to sort of start and complete a project, and to sort of do that over and over again. Because you really start to learn the shape of a story that way, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I think NaNoWriMo is really fun, but it really takes it out of you. And you realize by like the sort of 20th of November, when you've got no plot left and you just don't know words anymore, that you're literally just writing garbage just to get over the word count for the day. But it is fun. I would recommend it to people. I've done it, I think, twice successfully anyway. But yeah, you're right. It's a very intense thing to do when you've got other commitments, so maybe not
Yeah.
recommended all the time.
I definitely think it's worth doing if I think it's one of those things where you might not hit the 50,000 word mark, but the fact that you're joining so many people doing, all embarking on such a big creative journey together, I think that in itself is really valuable. And I always like to think that even if even if it's like 30,000 words or 20,000 words, those are still words you didn't have at the beginning of the year. So in that sense, it is super valuable.
Yeah, absolutely. And the whole kind of idea of a community around you doing the same thing at the same time is really motivating. It kind of almost encourages you to think, when even when you really don't want to kind of carry on, because you sort of feel like you're You're letting the team down if you don't, but
Yeah.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about the Everly family. Can you kind of give us a bit more about their background, their kind of how you created this family?
Yeah, so the Everleys are essentially three siblings, and then one daughter slash niece. So the Everleys start with sort of Marianne Everly, who's Violet's mother. She's the eldest of the siblings, and so she goes off to go break this curse when Violet is, very, very young and never comes back. So in her absence, her sort of Violet's two uncles, Ambrose and Gabriel, sort of step up to become parents for, as best as they can be. And I always think of them as like the jumper uncle and the leather jacket uncle. So Ambrose is kind of, the quiet academic uncle. He loves his jumpers. I was like looking back and I was like, oh, I do reference jumpers quite a lot in this book. I was called when I was writing it. And he sort of is sort of Violet's main parental figure. And it was really fun to kind of play with the idea that like, none of them really, neither of them sort of set out to be parents. And I think Ambrose is very young as well. He's the youngest sibling. So it was really important to me to try and get across that kind of sense of sort of imperfect love. They really are just sort of human and sort of thrust into this sort of position of responsibility quite unexpectedly. And it's sort of, it was really important to me to sort of get across that, that really aren't perfect. And, some of the decisions they make are worse for Violet, rather than, even if they're well-intentioned. So yeah, it was really fun to play with that and sort of play with this kind of sense of, the sort of sibling rivalries and sort of all of this sort of happening around Violet and really affecting her day to day.
And Violet herself, one thing I thought was really interesting was that in some ways she's quite an every woman, a kind of ordinary character. She works in a coffee shop, but then you're mixing the ordinary with a very extraordinary world and magic and curses. And I wondered whether this kind of mixture of the two was intentional on your part.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I think that that's, I think for a portal story, that's really, that sort of juxtaposition is really key. I think one of the things that I personally love about them is the idea that you can turn around the corner or like open the certain door, climb through the certain wardrobe and end up in this sort of extraordinary other world. So it was really important for me that she sort of felt ordinary. And I think as well, that sort of makes all her adventures seem more extraordinary. I think she goes off and does these things because she has to, but also not coming from this sort of mysterious, sort of more magical background that all the other characters have. And it's sort of very isolating for her, I think. But I feel like that's sort of where her strength as a character comes from and her bravery as a character comes from.
Okay, so let's talk about this world building then. The scope of this world you've created is just, I'm in awe of anyone that can do this. And I just wanted to hear about how you went about it. Do you have like diagrams and maps and notes and notebooks and pictures kind of all around your writing desk? Did you plan it all meticulously, or did you kind of feel the way around it and think about kind of, I guess, the tropes and the aspects of stories that you already love and kind of bring those into it? How did it all work?
Well, I think as my good friends could probably attest to, I don't plan anything in my life meticulously or otherwise. I mostly just, I mean, to an extent, I did think about what I wanted to create. I also wanted to just add in things that I love. Like, I love sort of magical parties. I love sort of hot people at magical parties, sort of swanning around in finery. I love the sense of adventure. So I think, that for me was kind of part of it was just sort of add, thinking about like what's, Lainey Taylor has this amazing sort of advice, which is sort of what's the coolest thing that can happen here. And that was really useful to sort of think about when I was sort of working on the world building. I knew I wanted it to feel like a fairy tale. But not one that necessarily came from a specific retelling. I really love that idea of like somebody's stumbled across a retelling of like a fake fairy tale almost. So that was really fun to think about. And I really hope that comes across in the book. I also wanted the world to feel really big. Like, you know, you could kind of walk off the last page and just keep going. And that does mean that, you know, you don't really understand maybe everything that's happened, or, you know, there are sort of some minor mysteries that are kind of left to be a bit mysterious. One author that I think does this amazingly is Garth Nix in his Abhorsen trilogy, which I loved growing up. And it's one of those really sort of interesting worlds where, you know, the main character, Sabriel, is sort of walking through this land that is, you know, has obviously been once grand and is sort of now largely like ruins. And there was just something so enticing about sort of her, like, for example, at one point she goes up these like massive set of stairs and she has no idea who's created the stairs or why they're there, but, you know, she knows they're there and that they've kind of had a magical element to it. Or she goes to like the Abhorsen house, which is sort of like basically the magician house, and she sort of gets to learn a little bit more about the people who were previously these sort of like magicians. It's just such an extraordinary thing to be able to sort of drop in these details, just, you know, really feed your imagination. And then leave it behind and leave it to be a bit mysterious and to leave you going, oh my God, like, you know, I bet I could go and like walk in this world and uncover all these mysteries. It's like, that was a feeling I really spent a lot of time thinking about when I was writing the book.
Do you like kind of leaving those gaps in for readers? I mean, obviously, I think particularly kind of fantasy novels have a fan following, unlike other books and other genres where, you know, fans create their own interpretation of the world and, you know, make maybe their own lore that slots nicely into one you've kind of created. Is that kind of something that you find quite exciting about creating a world?
You know, it's really funny because I unfortunately kind of missed the fan fiction boat for whatever reason, because that you know, that's a lot of people sort of that around my age, you know, that was their like first forays in sort of writing and into sort of a writer community and the fantasy community. And for some reason I completely missed that boat. I had no idea it even existed until I got to university and I was like, wait a minute, people do this? How cool. But I was mostly thinking about you know, that sort of sense of mystery and discovery, and I sort of really wanted to go back to that kind of almost classical sense of adventure. Like, you really, you know, you were kind of left to know that there's so much more to this world and you could really see yourself there. It was like a very delicate balance of making sure the reader has enough information, but not all the information.
And I wondered as well, obviously, to create a world that feels lived in and believable, you know, you have to make it as real as possible. And I wondered whether any part of Fidelis was, which is the city, was it based on anywhere or inspired by like anything or particular places that you'd, you know, when you were in lockdown and you were wishing you were elsewhere, was it inspired by other things you'd seen?
It actually was. I think, you know, it's not the most exciting sort of answer, but the truth is I love snow. I'm like, yes, I love snow. There's something so magical about it. I don't care. Like, I am never going to get tired of it. I would like beautiful snowy winters and then really gorgeous summers. And unfortunately, being in England, you kind of get neither. So I love mountains too. I just think there's something about that landscape that feels really like freeing and adventurous and really gorgeous. Maybe around 2015, 2016, I went on a backpacking trip, and actually a lot of the places that Violet goes to in that sort of particular section of the book, places that I went to, she sort of almost follows the journey. And one of the places I went to was this sort of French city in the mountains called Annecy, and it's really, really beautiful. And I ended up spending about a month there, sort of, you know, a few more years later on. There was just something about it that was like, oh my God, this feels so like idyllic. Like, it's called like the Little Venice of the Alps, and it's so beautiful there. And I just thought, that's like, if I could have that with snow, that would be such a wonderful, magical city to have.
I would like to also ask, obviously, about, we've talked about the world building, but I wondered whether And you've said you're not a planner, so I'm guessing, I don't know, what was the most challenging part of writing this book? I mean, maybe the plotting, I don't know. If you're not a planner, maybe the plotting is harder, but I don't know. You tell me, what was the hardest part of writing this book?
Everything. No, but kind
True,
of. I think in truth, I think the thing that I really struggled with, and the thing that I will probably always struggle with, is doubt. I think, there are really long stretches of time where it's just you and your keyboard and this book you're creating. On a sort of very technical level, a book is a series of, story is a series of decisions. And a lot of time it's just you there staring at the screen going, have I made the right decision? And they're not, they're smaller decisions, but there are big plot decisions, and that can really affect the trajectory of the book, and it's so you're sort of there thinking, well, is this the story I want to tell? Is this the story that's going to appeal to the readers that I want? Is this going to be like one of those things that tanks the book? And so yeah, I think there were quite a good few months sort of in between writing drafts where I was like, I hate this book. I made a terrible decision. But then of course the flip side of that is that you do get to points where you're like, oh my God, I've made the perfect decision here. This is phenomenal. Everyone's gonna love it. So it really is kind of like you swing quite hard emotionally between those two sort of places. And then you forget about it all. You finish the book and it just vanishes from your memory until the next time you write a book. And then you're like, oh, I do remember this feeling. I will also say for this particular book, it was really ambitious for me. There are not a lot of parameters around my world building because it takes place sort of, largely in our world. And so, that does make it hard to make decisions. When you've got sort of a lot of parameters around your book, you can be quite limited in your options. So that's sort of, picking the best, most interesting one. But if you've very few, then it sort of you have almost endless options. And then it becomes very difficult to decide what the best way forward is. So I think just working out that and trusting myself that it would pull through, I think was the most important thing.
It is hard when it's just you and the, I don't know, not the blank page, but the doc Word document, and you just think, I have no idea whether I guess I don't know whether writers, and I certainly sometimes feel like, okay, this has potential, but you never know for sure. Was there a moment where you thought this novel had maybe more potential than other things you'd written? Did you have like a kind of feeling that this had that kind of special ingredient, or were you just kind of in the dark about it?
So I, you know what? It's really funny because there actually is. I do this thing where I use Scrivener, and on Scrivener you can add a bunch of documents or sort of whatever. And I always have a document called the Captain's Log, which is kind of where I write how I'm feeling, which is how I know that I sort of had these like highs and these lows. And there's one moment I remember where I'd written this like for context. My book is sort of split up into different sections and sort of bookmarking these sections are these sort of this is sort of fairy tale, and every kind of story is a different take on this sort of original fairy tale in the book. And I'd written the first one, and it just, there was just something about it that I really loved, and I thought, you know what, maybe, I really liked what I've done here. Maybe this could be something like good. And I think that's kind of that feeling I had when I thought, well, maybe what I've got is gonna be at least interesting.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
You said you have written for a long time, since you were really young. I wondered whether there was a point in your life where you made a kind of conscious decision to turn your writing from a hobby and something you love doing into a career. And you were an editor, which we'll talk about in a bit. But was there a point in your mind where you thought, okay, now I'm going to try and aim to be published? Was that kind of conscious thought in your mind?
I mean, the really boring truth is that I don't remember. I've always taken my writing seriously. I mean, I have a letter from Random House because when I was about 9 or 10, I sent them a handwritten letter to ask about getting a novel published. and I have the, you know,
I love,
you know, there was before they were Penguin Random House. So, and I still have that. And you know, it's very, they obviously, like, this is the child, this is a literal child who's sort of sent this letter to us. So it's always been something that I've felt was really important to me. And it almost doesn't feel like a choice anymore. It just feels like something happened to me and now I'm like, yeah, this is what I'm going to do. So I've been very, very, you know, lucky in that respect that I've sort of knew what I wanted to do from literally before I could remember. And that I've kind of had the resources to be able to pursue it.
I'm interested to know, obviously, because you have been an editor and you've worked in publishing for a while, whether when you were writing, you were kind of conscious of things like comp titles, how the book would be marketed, like where it would fit, how it would appeal to editors, or if that just wasn't on your mind at all, or do you think it's hard to get that out of your head because obviously it was your job to kind of know all these things? Was it hard to separate the two, or do you see them as quite different things?
I think the truth is that once you kind of have a sense in your head, it is very difficult to sort of not have those little voices who are, you know, secretly, like, you know, the sales team or whatever in the background, you know, discussing something, or your editor going, oh, we loved this, but, you know, not this, and that's why we can't take it forward. You know, I thought a lot about, and I guess as a writer, as an author, there's not a lot you can do on that kind of art business scale. Like, you are really at the art end of the scale because you just don't have the resources, the financial resources, the connections to kind of push you up to the business end of the scale. And, you know, that's also, you know, that is where the traditional publisher comes in. So, you know, the things I did think I could control were things like, you know, do I want this to be like a 7-book series, or do I want this to be a standalone? What kind of audience do I want? Do I want to write something that's sort of in quite a tricky subgenre to write, you know, or do I want something that feels sort of maybe more accessible to people who don't read a huge amount of fantasy but might still really enjoy this? So yes, those were definitely, those were sort of things I was thinking about. But having said that, I do also think that there are choices that I've made in the narrative that I wouldn't call sort of commercial decisions. You know, I think my ending is maybe not the huge, I like my ending, but I don't think it's maybe like the most commercial decision to make, if that makes sense. And there's something, you know, and I think, you know, choosing to have a world that goes very unexplored in some aspects is maybe not a commercial decision. But you know, those felt true to my book as well. Like the reason why, you know, they are decisions, because I said, this is what I want my book to look like. It is a very tricky balance, I think, between art and business. And I think, you know, it's always going to feel like a little bit of a struggle between maybe, like, you know, everything that you want to write versus what is feasible in the publishing industry, what's realistic. And that, of course, that changes over the years, and what's popular now will not be popular in 20 years from now. And what's popular now was also not popular 20 years ago. I will also say you do get blind spots. Even as an editor, I wrote the first like 20,000 words in like, as from the point of view of the characters as sort of young teenagers. And my agent was like, so do you want this book to be adult or YA? And I was like, adult, definitely adult. And he was like, but you've written the big chunk of the book as teenagers. And I was like, oh yeah, I should know that. So, I definitely wouldn't say it's not sort of a wizard sort of calculating in their tower, like what the ultimate commercial novel looks like. I definitely had like quite a few blind spots when it came to my own work.
I think that's one thing that writers find kind of frustrating about the industry, is the kind of almost it's helpful to know these things and to be thinking of, comp titles, marketing, all that stuff. But like you said, kind of trends change so fast that you really would struggle to write to the market or what the market wants or what certain editors want. Because when you think about how long it takes to publish a book, you're talking 2 years, 18 months down the line. By that point, everyone might be particularly fed up of a certain type of genre or book or idea. And then if you've written a book that fits in that, you might think, I really missed the boat there. So I think it's hard. But I don't think you should necessarily lead by those things, but have them in your head at a certain point and think, I always remember my agent asking me, which I think is a really good question to think about, if you were on a literary festival panel or a book festival panel, who would be sitting either side of you? Like, which authors would be sitting next to you? And that's kind of how you think about who's in your gang, who's like going to be on the same shelf as you, kind of thing. And I think that's quite handy, even if you're not going, really deep in terms of, this is my comp title and these are the themes and this is the, just to kind of think about those things, even in a vague way, just even if you're like, well, I like this writer, so maybe they can sit next to me. That works.
Yeah, that's such a great question. That's such a great question. It's a thing, like a really good way of thinking about it that sort of maybe takes slightly less pressure off you if you're not, if it sort of starts to feel too like analytical to look at sort of comp titles and be like, well, this character is young in this, but my character is old, but otherwise it's very similar. I mean, I always like to think as well about like looking at, your favorite writers' careers, like what do they look like? Are they writing a book every year? Are they working in like a commercial space? Are they working in a more literary space? Are they writing a book every 10 years? Because that as well, I think, can sort of help guide you with what you want your career to look like long-term. And of course, a lot of that is outside of your control. But just having a think about, are you a book a year? You might not be. You might be a book every 3 years writer, and that might be what works for you. But then, you want to look at who's in your sort of area who's doing that, because I think that can be sort of a helpful guide.
Yeah, definitely. Can you give us a bit of an insight into your kind of getting your agent and how your book deal came about? Kind of if you know how long it took or kind of what the stages were like, if you can just give us the kind of that kind of querying journey to signing.
Yeah, so I got very, very lucky, I have to say. So it's about November 2019. I was sort of coming towards the tail. I'd been querying my second sort of novel that I'd sort of sent out as an adult. I got to a point where I was like, people really liked the pitch. They really liked the first couple of chapters. They were asking for the full manuscript. And then it was like, the full manuscript landed like a very sad, soggy pancake. And I was like, well, I know something's not working here. I know my weakness is structure. So I was like thinking like, how am I going to solve this problem? And so while I was doing that, I was sort of feeling a bit deflated about all of this. And I started writing what would become The City of Stardust. And then a couple months later, I saw this mentorship program offered, and it was a program where you only needed to send the first 15 to 20,000 words. And I was like, great, because those are the only good words in my book. So I sent that and I was very lucky. I got accepted into it and I got matched up with Robbie, who's still my agent now. And so together we kind of worked on the book for about a year and a half. I'm a very slow writer, it turns out. And then, you know, we kind of sort of got to a point where we were like ready to go out, and we sort of went out in the last week of May 2022. And I remember the day we went out, because literally an hour later my editor emailed back and was like, what else is she writing, what kind of are her plans? And I remember going, oh my god, like this is happening. Mm-hmm. And then a week later we had an offer, which was really, you know, I know publishing timelines are very varied. That is extremely unusual. It was very exciting for me. But, you know, I got exceptionally lucky. You know, it landed on her desk at the right time, with the right amount of workload for her. It was a real sort of meeting of fortune.
Mm. And obviously as a former editor, you've got that kind of insight, which we all of us crave, because the industry is quite opaque in terms of the information that is well known, I guess, and easily accessible. So you obviously understand kind of how the publishing industry works. You've been through it on the other side. What do you think is important for debut authors to know when they sign a contract? Kind of practical advice or emotional advice? Just about kind of getting through that period of being a debut, of being thrust out into the world with this first book.
I would say that the push and pull of art and business does exist. It is there. It is very frustrating, and it can be frustrating on both sides, which I think is important to acknowledge. You know, I think publishers, we go into publishing predominantly because we love books. Mm. But for authors who are signing that very first contract, you know, I don't know if anybody really talks about this, but buying a book as an editor is hard work. Like, it's not just your editor being like, I've seen it, I like it, let's buy it. I wish it was like that. So, you know, it's like, you know, you've got to fill out a whole bunch of forms, you have to go to a bunch of meetings, and you have to get everybody else on board. So it means talking to like the sales team, marketing and publicity, finance, production, you know, depending on what your book is, how your book is going to be produced. And you know, you sort of will send it out for reads, and sometimes it's sort of widely across the company. And so, the rights team will be looking at it, and everybody has to say yes. Everybody has to be on board with the book, because it is not just the editor's time, it is everybody's time. So when, you know, a book ends up, you know, and then of course you have to sort of go through the process of acquiring, which is, you know, the acquisition process itself is a lot of work and a lot of negotiating usually. So when you're signing that contract, it's because everybody loved your book, it's because everybody's excited about your book and the things they can do for it, which I think sometimes, you know, gets lost. And it is it's hugely exciting. I think it's always really, you know, as I recall, it was always like so much fun to get like the book on the desk and be like, oh my god, I want this, we have to. But you know, that's kind of, and then you know, that was kind of the most exciting and rewarding parts for me. So I guess given how much uncertainty there is in publishing, that is sometimes nice to remember. It's, you know, it's not just one person. It's such a big team who are looking after your book. And there are so many more people than you will ever know who look after your book in some form or another.
And all want it to succeed.
Yes.
And you were saying earlier, like just before we started recording, knowing kind of how the process works made you a lot calmer about not getting an email from your editor or everything going quiet for a while. Do you think that aspect of it, you would kind of just advise people to just kind of sit back and trust that things are happening behind the scenes, even if they're not aware of it?
I think it's a really delicate balance, because of course, you know, publishers are just people in the way that everybody is just people. There will be people who are really great at certain aspects of the job and less great at others, or, you know, there will be people who will feel better than others, or sort of better for what you want out of your publishing experience than others. I would say, you know what, treat it, it is a business. It is a business relationship. You know, the publisher is working with you. So, you know, if you have questions, if you have concerns, I think, you know, flag it with your agent. You know, I think your agent will have like a lot of context to see whether this is whether they can say, oh, actually, you know, this is like a very normal part of the process, or whether they can say, actually, no, this is quite unusual. You know, let's check it. Like, you know, you don't have to have all the difficult conversations yourself. That's why you have an agent to do the difficult conversations for you. But if you have questions, you know, you can ask. I think that's kind of an important thing to do. The editors are, you know, I think editors maybe seem scary because they're sort of quite a big part of this, you know, they are a big part of the publishing process. But yeah, I don't think any editor has ever been that frightened of a question, as far as I'm aware. So yeah, I think it's important to sort of ask questions, and sort of, you know that it's okay to feel uncertain, because the truth is that there are a lot of reasons, you know, there are a lot of options when it comes to publishing. And I think, you know, my caveat is always, I only know this from what I have learned in publishing, and, you know, what my career in publishing is, it looks very different to other people's, because it is such a wide industry in that sense.
Was there anything then that surprised you about the process, even be it kind of you found it a lot harder emotionally to deal with, or there were times where you thought, oh, okay, I understand what my authors went through now?
Yes, it goes back to like the doubt, and to, you know, I was very calm about the business aspect, but I was not calm about myself. And just having those really long stretches of time where you start to go, oh my God, did I write this the way I wanted to? Could I have done this better? You know, especially when the first reviews come, like, just don't look at the reviews. It's like, I always say, it's like sticking your hand into a hive and hoping for honey and just getting mostly bees, or sometimes sticky bees, and nobody wins. You know, it's too late to change it. The honest truth is, by then, it is too late to change the book. You have all the mistakes you have made, all the regrets you have, they're there on print forever. So there's no point in worrying about it, even though, of course, we all worry about it. I worried a lot about it. So I think that was the most surprising thing, that even though I knew this, I knew all of this going in, and that, you know, really publishers are, you know, the publishers are looking to make money. They're looking for sales. So, you know, if you get like one bad review, you know, that's unlikely to have like a massive knock-on effect on your book. You know, even then, it was still emotionally a lot harder than I thought it was. And I was like, oh, this, you know, this explains a lot. This is not like the like classic laid-back feeling I thought it would be. But I think, you know, from what I can gather, a lot of people feel like this. So, you know, it's nice to know that sort of everybody, we're all sort of in that boat of terror together.
Yeah, absolutely. So finally, Georgia, can you give us a little tease, a little taste of what's coming next? What are you working on at the moment?
Yeah, so I'm late on my edits for this book. I am working on a new standalone. It is about a book thief who inherits a magical bookshop. Only lots of people are after this magical bookshop, including this very shady society, and this rival bookseller, who is a very attractive rival bookseller, who also really wants this bookshop for himself. So, you know, it's going to have sort of ink magic and, you know, sort of magical sort of estate sales, and hopefully have that same kind of mix of, you know, sort of the fairy tale glamour, but also that kind of like edged darkness that the City of Stardust has.
Brilliant. I mean, who doesn't love the idea of a magical bookshop? Georgia, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been such a delight to be on it.
That was Georgia Summers talking about her fantasy novel, The City of Stardust, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.